Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
One of the president's ride or die defenders is legal advisor Jenna Ellis.
It's such a political prosecution and a political persecution.
Quote,
this to me is a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's revisionist originalism. Tolerance just isn't a two-way street with the Democrats. And I think that tells you all we need to know.
Newsmax contributor and former legal counsel to President Trump.
Jenna Ellis.
Good morning. I hope we are all adjusting to the time change. I know I'm not, so I have a lot of coffee this morning, but it's always great to be with you in the mornings. And we have a lot of headlines for you in this first segment, and then some great guests today to talk about some other headlines. I know you were not going to want to miss that. So first off this morning, Moody's Investor Service downgrades the U.S. banking system to negative following the worst bank failure since 2008. So according to Town Hall, following the biggest bank failure since the financial crisis of 2008, Moody's Investor Service has downgraded its rating of the U.S. banking system in the latest sign that President Biden's Monday morning attempt to assuage concerns went over like a lead balloon. Haha. So Town Hall poking some fun there at Biden. I wonder if the lead balloon was from China. Well, Moody's, which is one of the three major rating entities, downgraded its outlook for the U.S. banking system from stable to negative on Tuesday morning to reflect the rapid deterioration of the operating environment following the deposit runs at Silicon Valley Bank, Silvergate Bank, and Signature Bank, and the failures of these banks. And so, according to CNBC, the rates rose as the Federal Reserve battled an inflation surge that took prices to their highest levels in more than 40 years. So Moody's said it expects the Fed to continue the hiking, and the firm said it expects the U.S. economy to fall into recession later this year, further pressuring the industry. So, of course, our friend and presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy has been tweeting quite a lot about this. So if you are heavily interested in this topic, I would encourage you to follow him on Twitter. Of course, there has been a lot on social media discussing this and the possible issues that will face the U.S. economy later this year. It'll be interesting how all of this plays into the presidential election and whether or not Joe Biden is going to announce his candidacy. You know, that's still, it remains to be seen. And Alan West was with us earlier this week and said, you know, and I would agree with his analysis that the longer that Joe Biden waits, you know, it may be that the Democrats are looking at potentially getting someone else. So very interesting. Also this morning, Joe Biden signs an executive order enhancing background checks and red flag laws for gun buyers. So for those of us who like to exercise our Second Amendment rights and the constitutionally protected right to keep and bear arms, the Democrats are coming for it. And President Biden issued an executive order yesterday that reinforced background checks for gun buyers in what the White House is promoting as the most comprehensive policy the president can enact without Congress. So that remains to be seen. I have no doubt that our friends at the NRA and some other organizations are going to take a long and hard look at this executive order and see whether or not there can be some legal challenges, of course, in the wake of the Heller decision and others last year that, of course, the current composition of the Supreme Court has protected our Second Amendment rights. And so this executive order aims to strengthen federal support for red flag laws that are intended, according to Reuters, to stop gun sales for people who are deemed dangerous. Of course, my position as an attorney on red flag laws are that I've never read one or met one that isn't, in my view, unconstitutional, because what red flag laws attempt to do is punish a person up front for just a thought crime or a potential crime that they may at some point in the future commit, But these are very, very dangerous because what happens under red flag laws are that anyone, even generally your neighbor, your friend, it doesn't even have to be an immediate family member in many instances under many states' red flag laws, can call law enforcement, say that you are suspect for whatever their reasons that are given. And then if your right to keep and bear arms is taken away and you have to turn over your guns, then you actually have to go to court and prove, you have the burden of proof to show why you should be able to exercise your constitutionally protected right. And in no other instance, for example, in our religious freedom exercise under the First Amendment, it would be ridiculous if the government came and said, you know what, Jenna, I think that you need to prove why you have the right to go to church and that that's not going to be a danger to society or a danger to your fellow churchgoers. So let's have a hearing and you have to show to the court why you should be able to exercise your religious freedom. That is completely antithetical to our system of government, to how the Constitution protects and preserves our rights. And it's no different when we're talking about Second Amendment rights compared to any other right. And so even though the government would like to suggest that they have the authority to implement some of these red flag laws, and apparently the Biden administration is also strengthening this policy to promote and protect red flag laws in the states, these are still really dangerous laws that have really grave consequences for our ability to keep and protect our arms, because in no other instance do we punish someone up front when they may potentially possibly commit a crime in the future and take away their ability to exercise their rights. And in no instance should a person have to prove to the government first why we are able to exercise our constitutionally protected rights. So this will be very interesting to see some of the reaction, like I said, from our friends at the NRA and some of these other Second Amendment nonprofits and law firms that very closely look at Second Amendment protections for individuals. You know, this is just yet another way that the Democrats are trying to focus on guns instead of focus on the culture and the worldview, because, you know, a lot of different tools can be used to commit crimes and commit murders. It's always the person's intent. And if we as a culture valued each other as human beings made in the image of God, and we taught our children that, and we had a much better culture, then, you know, I think that would be a much better thing for the Biden administration to focus on. But of course, they're always focused on the guns. They're focused on the wrong issue and the wrong solution. But of course, you know, that's Democrats. So interestingly as well, in terms of the legal, Ohio sues the Norfolk Southern Railway for damages after the train derailment. So keep an eye on that case as well. The Ohio Attorney General's office filed a complaint against Norfolk Southern Railway in federal court on Tuesday, alleging that the company violated hazardous waste and water quality laws and was negligent for causing the train derailment and toxic chemicals released last month in East Palestine, Ohio. So this lawsuit, according to NBC, adds to the railway's legal woes in the wake of the train derailment and subsequent release of toxic chemicals, which the complaint says includes more than 1 million gallons of hazardous materials. So keeping an eye on that. And I think the Ohio General Attorney General's office is making a good move there to hold the railway company accountable for that disaster in East Palestine, which, by the way, Joe Biden has yet to visit. You know, this is now months after the fact. And I think it's just absolutely ridiculous that Joe Biden can he's now apparently scheduled to go over to Ireland. He's going literally everywhere else besides East Palestine, Ohio, which just tells you that he doesn't really care about the American people. He cares a lot more about his personal foreign allies than he does about the American people. But speaking of, you know, foreign allies, The situation in Ukraine is also very interesting, and Tucker Carlson had a very interesting clip this week where he asked all of the potential and announced GOP presidential candidates their position on Ukraine. Listen to what Tucker Carlson said. This is clip one.
Last week, we sent a questionnaire to every Republican presidential candidate announced and potential asking about Ukraine. We posed six questions. Is opposing Russia in Ukraine a vital strategic interest for America? What's our objective in Ukraine and how are we going to know when we've achieved it? What is the limit of money and weapons you'd be willing to send to Zelensky? Have U.S. sanctions been effective? And does the United States face the risk of nuclear war with Russia? It's kind of presumptuous for a cable show to send these, but no one else in the media seemed to be asking them, and we thought we should. The first presidential primaries are 10 months away. Voters should know where their candidates stand on the big issues, and this in some ways is the biggest issue. So tonight we're happy to report that virtually everyone we asked responded. Nikki Haley ignored us. John Bolton said he was too busy doing some unspecified thing. But most of the rest of them did get back to us, and we are grateful that they did. In general, the answers were fascinating. Some of them were so thoughtful and so smart, they give you hope for the Republican Party. With only a few exceptions, their answers bore no resemblance at all to the statements you see every day from Mitch McConnell and various Republican committee chairmen in the Congress. Republicans in Washington tend to be committed neocons in the Hillary Clinton mold. But Republicans running for president this cycle generally are not at all. That was a surprise, a refreshing surprise. We had no idea. We didn't know what to think. So we're going to post every response that we got in full on our Twitter account tonight as a public record of where the candidates stand on Ukraine. We hope you will look at them.
So interestingly, Tucker Carlson did post all of the candidates' responses in full on his Twitter page. But if you go there this morning, for all of the responses on Ukraine, if you click on showing the thread, then the tweets are actually unavailable. And I don't know why that is. I think that that's really fascinating because the clip and the fuller clip that I just played from Tucker, he actually did go and read through all of the GOP candidates' responses. And that included President Trump, of course, who has announced, that included Vivek Ramaswamy. Very, very interestingly, that also included Governor Ron DeSantis, who, of course, has not announced for president. But the fact that he responded to Tucker as a potential, I think, is our biggest indicator yet that he does intend to step into the race to try to get his perspective on Ukraine actually out there. And I thought he had a very good response. So the only one that actually shows up today is former Governor Chris Christie on Ukraine. And then the tweet where Tucker says the following GOP presidential hopefuls did not respond, which included Nikki Haley. Interesting. I wonder why she wouldn't want to give her perspective on Ukraine. Is it because she's potentially a neocon? Well, you know, that's anybody's guess. Mike Pompeo did not respond. Asa Hutchinson, of course, John Bolton, who's probably over, you know, getting his mustache waxed or something. And then Governor Chris Sununu, of course, of New Hampshire. So those candidates and potential candidates didn't respond. But I think it's very interesting as well, not only that Governor DeSantis did respond, but that the top presidential candidates all said and had very good responses that were not in line with the kind of uniparty warmongering establishment. And yesterday as well, the Senate Republicans said that that perspective broke with their stance. And of course, you know, Congress has and including the Senate has voted to continue to send billions of dollars to Ukraine. And so to me, this is a really great departure from the kind of warmongering Republican establishment that we have seen typically, that is further promoting a war in Ukraine when we don't really know what is the goal. Can anybody in the Senate who is against this really articulate that goal? Well, we're going to be talking about this more in the next segment with my good friend Jeffrey Lord. So stick around for that, and we will be talking more about Ukraine, about these presidential candidates' responses, and what that may signal for 2024. So you are listening to Jenna Ellis in the Morning, and we will be right back with more here on American Family Radio Network.
The following is not an actor, but a real-life story from Trinity Debt Management.
I'm Corey, and this is my story. I was going through some financial troubles paying off my credit cards. I was paying high interest rates, and it just wasn't getting any better. And I knew I had to do something. So my mom told me about Trinity, and so I decided to call. Trinity was able to do something that I couldn't. I'm paying off my debt, I'm saving thousands, and things are really looking up. I promise you guys, you will not regret it when you call Trinity, because it was such a relief and less stress in my life, and it was the best thing I could have done for myself, because once I called Trinity, they took care of me, and I felt such a relief, a weight off my shoulders, and they are a Christian-based company. I love it.
If you're in debt and you need help, call Trinity at 1-800-788-1813.
I'm Corey, and I'm debt-free for keeps.
1-800-788-1813.
Let's be real. Retirement is expensive, and inflation is making it even harder with the cost of everything going up, from pet food to a dozen eggs. Wouldn't it be great if the cost of your health care could go down? Well, MediShare 65 Plus is $99 a month for ages 65 to 74. And for many with Medicare Parts A and B, looking at other options, that's 50% or more saved per month. No gimmicks. It's $99 a month, and you can use any Medicare-approved doctor or facility, and you get 24/7 access to telehealth from the convenience of your home. Better yet, MediShare is a Christian nonprofit organization. It's a community that'll pray for you and encourage you. And since we've cut out the middleman, you get to keep the savings. Call now. You can learn more about MediShare 65 Plus. Here's the number. 833-45-BIBLE. That's 833-45-BIBLE. 833-45-BIBLE.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stern. Stand by for news and commentary next.
Liberty University's K-12 Online Academy is the best of a homeschool, private school, and Bible-based education all rolled into one. With LUOA, you can take charge of your child's learning environment and create a structured yet flexible schedule that works for your family. Our qualified teachers are easily accessible for guidance and support along the way. And with new classes starting every Monday, it's never too late to make a switch to LUOA. To learn more, text LUOA to 88741. That's LUOA to 88741.
The annual White House Easter egg roll has ruffled feathers among the anti-meat crowd. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals is calling on the First Lady to stop using real chicken eggs in the Easter egg roll. Instead, the anti-poultry crowd wants the White House to use either plastic eggs or wooden eggs. And if those options aren't available, they recommended painted rocks. PETA says the problem with using real eggs is that vegan children might feel excluded. In 2019, American farmers donated more than 70,000 eggs for the annual Easter tradition. PETA even offered to provide a vegan egg-free scramble for volunteers. But let's get real. Nobody's going to be lining up for scrambled tofu. As for PETA, they're more than happy to hop on down that bunny trail and dye whatever they want, rocks or a block of fermented soy. Meanwhile, the rest of us are going to be on the White House lawn doing our best not to give a cockle-doodle care. I'm Todd Starnes.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and this is Jenna Ellis in the Morning, and I'd like to welcome in my good friend Jeffrey Lord, who is a contributor to the American Spectator and was an advisor in the Reagan White House. So he's been doing this a long time. So, Jeffrey, you have seen a lot of these administrations and candidates come and go. And so overall, first, good morning, and also, what is your perspective on all of these candidates, specifically Governor Ron DeSantis, actually answering Tucker Carlson's question about Ukraine?
Well, good morning there, Jenna. You know, I have to say, I think that we would not have a problem in Ukraine if Donald Trump were president. And there's a reason for that. As you mentioned, I worked for President Reagan, and his motto was peace through strength. And the communists of the day never messed with him because they knew that he meant what he said, and that if they did do something outrageous, he would respond. And, you know, one of the interesting things about this, seemingly unconnected to all of this, but it was very much connected, in August of 1981, the air traffic controllers union, which ironically had supported Reagan in the election, decided to go out on strike. And of course, it was illegal because federal employees are not allowed to strike. Well, President Reagan said, if you strike, I will fire you. And everybody in the Washington establishment, oh, he's not going to do that. There's 11,000 of them. You can't fire air traffic controllers. They went out on strike. He fired them. Now, eventually it was settled. But my point is that we later found out that this really took the Soviet Union aback because they said, my God, he actually means what he says.
Right.
And that, I think, is very much the case with Donald Trump, that they felt, that Putin and others felt, you know, don't mess around with him because you don't know what he'll do. I don't think they feel that with Joe Biden. And so, therefore, I think this is one of the reasons we've got this Ukraine problem going on in the first place, because the Russians just felt they could take advantage of old Uncle Joe, and in went the troops. So now we're in a mess here. And, you know, people like you and me and your audience talk about what we see with Joe Biden in terms of his cognitive problems and all this kind of thing. But we're not the problem. The problem is, what does Vladimir Putin think when he sees it? What does Xi Jinping think when he sees it? What is Kim Jong-un, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? This is really a problem here, and we are going to be left with the results, and it's not good.
It's not. And I'm talking with Jeffrey Lord, of course, was an advisor in the Reagan White House and a contributor to the American Spectator. And you raise a really great point, Jeffrey, that if Donald Trump were still in the White House, then this wouldn't be happening. And I cannot imagine how frustrating it must be to President Trump. And you know, and he speaks about this openly. You and I both were there at his speech at CPAC, and you know, him talking about the failures of Joe Biden, and to watch how he has taken this country in such a direction that is so damaging to the American people in so many different ways. I mean, we can talk about, you know, the economy, we can talk about all kinds of things, but even just with our relationships with our allies, but then also with our enemies and on the world stage and with foreign policy, it is just a total disaster, because I think everyone, including all of these other foreign leaders, can see that Joe Biden is not really all there. He's not mentally competent. And, you know, this raises an interesting question, though, because President Trump has said that he agrees with a mental competency test for candidates, which I think was first raised by Nikki Haley. And, you know, I think the American people would like to see that. But in my view, that can also raise some other questions that are more subjective in terms of, okay, so where then would be the line of qualification? Who gets to decide? And if the people wanted to contemplate that in the context of a constitutional amendment, I might think, okay. But at the very least, I think that even if it's not a requirement, it should be something that candidates are willing to openly discuss and provide, because we're seeing the detriment that that Joe Biden has caused to the United States just over the last 2 years. So, you know, what do you think is going to happen in terms of Joe Biden actually announcing another presidential run? I don't see how he can stay in office even for another 2 years. I'm surprised he's lasted this long, much less another four after that.
Well, you know, Jenna, I'll tell you, I have a real personal take on this. My mom passed away in 2018 at the age of 99. When she got to be about 96, 97, she started down the ever so gentle path of dementia. And mm-hmm. as I often explain to people, it's not a sharp drop off the cliff. It's a very gentle day by day, month by month decline. And I took care of her during all of this. And I have to tell you, every time I see Joe Biden, I see good old mom. Because I just, you know, you watch him and he gets baffled as to where he is. He doesn't know who somebody is. He doesn't know who a member of his cabinet is. He goes to shake hands with somebody. There's nobody there. This is seriously a problem, and it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. And the notion that he can even make it through today, let alone the next 2 years, much less 4 years after that, I think is highly questionable here. I mean, he quite clearly has a problem. Everybody can see it. And I can tell you from personal experience, this is going to get worse.
And I'm so sorry for your experience. And you know, my grandfather as well had dementia before he passed away. And I've known a few other closer friends who have also suffered from that. And it is. I mean, it's very sad to see, you know, someone who is in the prime of their life and then, you know, ends up being so confused and disoriented and ultimately frustrated and dealing with these things. And I've said for a long time that I can't imagine what Jill Biden must be thinking. I can't imagine someone who would allow their spouse to go through something like this just to, you know, be the first lady or just to be in power, right, or whatever is her motivation. I think it's...
Well, you know, Jenna, one of the things I talk about, and I don't know whether a lot of people are familiar with this, but to go back to the presidency of Woodrow Wilson, who was president, the Democrat president during World War One. The victory is won, and in 1919, he goes over to France to negotiate the Treaty of Versailles that ends the war formally. And he gets in there the creation of what was then called the League of Nations. He comes back to America, and the League of Nations idea is not very popular because there are plenty of people in the day, Republicans in the U.S. Senate, who had to approve it, who felt that it was giving up U.S. sovereignty. So Wilson decides he's going to do a cross-country train trip to campaign for this. He does. He's out there giving speeches all the time, all this kind of. The train gets to somewhere outside of Boulder, Colorado. It's nighttime. He's not feeling well. They stop the train in a farmer's field, walk him around for a little bit, put him back on the train, put him to bed. He gets up in the morning. His wife takes one look at him and says, you're not going to do this anymore. We're going back. They go back to the White House. 2 days later, she gets up in the morning and finds him on the floor of the bathroom, unconscious, his head bleeding. She calls the doctor, the White House physician. They lift him up, put him in bed. The bottom line, he had a stroke. Now, here's where this gets interesting. The cabinet says, okay, we need a statement of disability. The wife, the doctor, and his private secretary, a guy named Joseph Tumulty, who'd been with him since he was governor of New Jersey, all refused and said, Woodrow Wilson has been so good to us, there's no way we're going to sign off on this. So they didn't tell anybody. And what happens? The doctor says to Mrs. Wilson, he can't take pressure. So you're going to have to keep people, you know, who want decisions away from him. You'll have to make the decisions. So in secret, Mrs. Wilson was making decisions. In essence, we've already had a woman president. Her name was Edith Bowling Galt Wilson. Now, I know this story very well, and I look at the Biden White House, and I say, you know, we may all be gone from this planet when we find out what's really going on inside the Biden White House and who's making decisions. I mean, I've worked for a president. It's very, very demanding, obviously. And you just look at Joe Biden, and you say, I don't think he's up to this. I think they've got some sort of system in the Biden White House. I don't know whether it's Jill Biden. I don't know whether it's his chief of staff. I don't think it's Kamala Harris because I don't think they particularly like her. But I think that we will eventually find out, American history will eventually relate that decisions are being made here and not by Joe Biden.
I think you're right, and I think that the American people deserve to know the answer to that question, and especially if he announces a next presidential run, and if he says, I want to run for re-election, that needs to be the foremost question, is transparency on that issue. And And I don't think that obviously the Biden White House is going to be forthcoming with that. And of course, they'll still try to maintain that, you know, Biden is making these decisions, even though we know that he's not. But I think that compared to his campaign in 2020, just hiding in the basement, reading the teleprompter, having the questions in advance, he's not going to be able to do the same thing for 2024. So the Democrats have to be seriously questioning what is their next move and whether or not they can maintain this charade moving forward into 2024. And looking at the contrast, Jeffrey Lord, between the Biden White House and the utter disaster that it is on so many different levels that we've already even discussed this morning, and the contrast between the top candidates for 2024, which, of course, I think are going to come down to Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis, there's no way in a debate scenario that Joe Biden can perform even as well as he did in 2020 against Donald Trump. And so when we look at coming back to the Ukraine issue, and we look at how these GOP candidates are answering the question about Ukraine, I think it's going to be very fascinating in the primary to answer that question of who are we choosing, kind of a pick your fighter situation between Donald Trump running again for a second term, or the new guy, Ron DeSantis, who's done a really great job in Florida. And interestingly, both of them answered this question about Ukraine along similar lines. President Trump said exactly what you did, that this wouldn't have happened if he were in office. And Ron DeSantis was very firm that that the objective of America in Ukraine is not being fulfilled. It's not even being remotely considered and articulated very well. So what do you think the voters on the GOP side need to consider when we look at this contrast and when we are choosing our fighter headed into 2024?
Oh, I think they'll want to know who can get the job done. I mean, the advantage that President Trump has is that he was president, and people know more or less exactly how he would conduct the office. I mean, the problem for Governor DeSantis, and it's the problem for anybody who is running for president who is not president, is that people wind up, you know, they take under advisement what the candidate says, but then they're thinking, well, can he or she really get it done? And I think that's going to be the question for Governor DeSantis. I think if Donald Trump left the scene today, Governor DeSantis would probably be the overwhelming choice for the nomination. But President Trump is very much on the scene. He's very active. I live here in the middle of Pennsylvania. I drive around. I still see Trump for president signs here. People aren't leaving him, which some people I think were expecting. It hasn't happened. And as you noted, CPAC, good Lord, that place was a sea of red hats.
Yes, it was. There.
So I think he's got a real advantage. And, I think Governor DeSantis can get there eventually. But I just think that this is probably not the moment.
And I would agree with you that President Trump is the presumptive nominee. He's not the incumbent, which I think is interesting and does put him in a different posture in terms of whether people feel like they need to necessarily support him versus having more of an open choice. But he is the presumptive nominee, and I would agree with you that it's his to lose at this point, and it'll be interesting to see where he takes that. And in just the last about 30 seconds I have with you, Jeffrey Lord, what was your impression of his comments yesterday in Iowa, where even on the plane going back, there's a great article from my friend Henry Rogers for the Daily Caller saying that even on the flight back, President Trump was just slamming Ron DeSantis, calling him names, and choosing what his nickname is going to be. Is that going to be helpful to President Trump? I don't think so.
Well, I don't think he can help himself doing this. I did an interview with him in 2014, and I said, Republicans think that their nominees don't fight, that they get nominated a Romney McCain and the press runs all over them, they don't fight back. I said, would you fight back? He says, oh, don't worry. I'll fight back. We now know that that's true. So I think this is just typical, true to form for him. And I don't think that is going to change.
All right. Well, Jeffrey Lord, really appreciate your time this morning. Hope to talk with you again soon. You're one of my favorite people who comments, and it was great to see you at CPAC. You can follow Jeffrey Lord at Real Jeffrey Lord on Twitter, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You're listening to the American Family Radio Network.
Are you running away from God? Lots of things can cause people to turn their back on God. Maybe you feel God let you down. Maybe you got tangled in sin, or maybe you just got busy with life. Do you remember the story about the prodigal son in the Bible? When this wayward son returned home, he was met with open arms by his dad. That's the way your Heavenly Father feels about you. Come back to God. He's waiting for you. I'm Pastor John Miller. Visit me at churchontherock.org.
What would you do?
Aunt Sadie, I appreciate your thought behind the gift card, but I just can't take it. I promise not to shop at Target because they allow men in areas that need to be private and protected for women and children. I hope you'll go to afa.net/target and learn about it. I'm not giving them my money.
Aunt Sadie didn't know about AFA's call to boycott Target, but she knows now, and so do you. Learn even more at afa.net/target. afa.net/target.
And without faith, it's impossible to please him. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. After receiving letters from more than 20 Republican attorneys general threatening legal action, Walgreens, the second largest pharmaceutical chain in America, has announced it will not dispense abortion-inducing drugs either by mail or in their physical stores in 21 states. Those states are Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, Utah, and West Virginia. Hopefully, Walgreens' announcement will stir CVS, Walmart, Costco, and others to follow suit. With Roe's reversal, the battleground to protect the unborn has moved largely to the pharmacy.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner, or visit the podcast page at AFR.net for more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Persecuted believers in Asia, they love their enemies and they count it all joy to suffer for the Lord. This is Bible League International. Abir is a former Islamic leader in Bangladesh. When he became a believer, he was beaten, verbally abused, his home was vandalized, he was forced to move to another city, and he was labeled a traitor. But he holds to the precious promises of God he reads every day in his Bible.
I asked Abir, "You were beaten, you were cast out. It's so easy to hate people that do this to you." He said, "No, I love them."
Most of us here in America cannot relate to the level of persecution that Christians like Abir in Bangladesh and others throughout Asia are facing on a daily basis. Let's send them the Word of God they need and crave to be able to endure and persevere. And that's why we're holding this campaign, Fan the Flame. $5 sends a Bible, $100 sends 20, every gift matched. Call 800-YES-WORD, 800-YES-WORD, or give it sendbiblesnow.org. Sendbiblesnow.org, and God bless you for caring.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Well, Project Veritas released another video last week that, you know, is just continuing to show why parents need to get engaged and involved in their school districts if your children are going to a public school. So this is in New York, and the New York Assistant Superintendent covertly is pushing DEI, the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion agenda within the school district, says that politics is his job now, and claims that his sexual identity is more important to make connections with kids, and reveals the explosion of trans students in the wake of the COVID pandemic. So this gentleman, the assistant superintendent for curriculum and instruction of East Meadow School District, says, quote, "Here's the thing with DEI work. If you push too hard doing the work and you get this pushback, it will be decades before you can do the work again. So it needs to be incremental." He also says on this video from Project Veritas, they, the parents, honestly believe that systematic racism does not exist. They don't understand why we have to talk about LGBTQ issues or have books that have LGBTQ themes in them. He says, politics is basically my job now. I am political in every conversation I have. I never thought I'd be at this point in my life. I am, and it is what it is. If you can do the game, you can do good work. He also says, quote, my sexual identity was always part of my work because I believe in making connections with kids. This is really incredibly disturbing. And parents need to understand that this isn't just about having a rainbow flag in the room and saying, you know, let's tolerate, your fellow student if they happen to be from a home that has two moms or two dads. I mean, this is specifically geared from instructors, the superintendents of schools, from educators to enforce an agenda on children. So joining me now is Kevin Smith, who is the founder of The Loud Majority. And Kevin, good morning. And you were based out of New York as well. And so you are doing some great work with The Loud Majority to push back against these types of covert politics that are actually shielding what's going on in the education system from kids.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's terrifying because we seem to spend all of our time talking about the politics of Washington, D.C. And that's because, you know, it's in our faces so much, or because of the 24-hour news cycle and cable news. But, you know, you drop your kids off for 8 hours a day to these people, and you assume that they are going to have the best intentions for your kids. You assume they're going to get an education. And as we've seen in the latest Project Veritas video, that's just not happening.
Yeah, and you're so right that I think that the presumption has been from parents up until a few years ago. I mean, obviously not everyone, but I think overall the general assumption was I'm dropping my kids off to school to learn reading, writing, arithmetic, and, you know, making sure that they're prepared to eventually go to college, eventually go into the workforce, you know, those kinds of basic things. And of course, socialization is part of that, and that's always the pushback against, you know, homeschooling families like mine. You know, the question that my parents always got was, you know, oh, what about, you know, socializing and all of that? But I think we do have to talk about this and go deeper, because parents are starting to rightly question the motives and the agenda behind these educators that appear to be specifically engaged in the education system just to promote these kind of this kind of indoctrination to children. And interestingly, though, they're promoting it, but they want to do it covertly, shielding that from the parents. What does that tell you?
Well, you know, anytime you have to hide something, it's probably because you're doing something wrong. If this was totally out in the open and, you know, they were like, let's just, you know, let's send an email to the parents, that would tell me that they don't believe there's anything wrong with this. But because they have to hide it, that tells me that they know that they're going to get pushback. And as we saw in the most recent Project Veritas video, an assistant superintendent from Manhasset School District talks about how the reason why he has to be so covert about it is because of the extremism in some of the right-wing parents. Now, this is so new. I mean, I went to high school 15 years ago, so it's not like I'm talking about, you know, my grandfather, you know, going to school 100 years ago. This just didn't happen when we went to high school. This didn't happen in the public schools as I remember it. And seeing how they have to talk about it at their little meetings, their little, obviously shows you that they are attempting to indoctrinate your kids in some sort of way that they know you wouldn't be okay with.
Right. I mean, if DEI is so good, then why would teachers be covertly utilizing it? Why wouldn't they say to parents openly, this is what we're teaching our kids, and why don't you be partners with us so that you make sure to have, you know, DEI metrics in your home and you know, all of these things, that if they were very open about it? Because likely they know that most parents, or a good portion of them at least, would push back. And they're seeing that when parents are coming to the local school board meetings and saying, we disagree with this, and we want to know the content of our children's education. We want to know the books that are being read. And they're pushing back against, obviously, sexually explicit material. They're pushing back against a lot of this. And so So now educators, instead of saying, okay, sure, here's what we're doing openly, and parents, you're free to disagree with it, but this is what we're doing, and, you know, you can take your kid somewhere else, they're doing it covertly, even to the point that, you know, we're hearing reports of teachers that will call children by a different pronoun and even a different name, and have these, you know, secret closets of, as Pedro Gonzalez, who's an excellent investigative reporter, has said, and he has some substacks about this, that there are actually closets in some schools where teachers then allow the children to change into clothing of a different gender than theirs. And then they hide that from the parents when they go home. I mean, so all of this is clearly an agenda to break that bond and the trust bond between the child and the parent as well. And so I don't see this even just as a as an indoctrination of leftist ideology. It's obviously that, but it's also specifically intended, I think, to have children from a very, very young age distrust their parents, and when they go home, feel like, oh, that's not the safe space. I need to go back and I need to trust what my teachers are saying over and above the parents.
Absolutely. And, it, you know, the maliciousness of it gets even worse since COVID, because now you have many schools, particularly out here on Long Island. I'm sure this trend is nationwide as well. But the schools will give the students laptops or iPads or Chromebooks. And they're able to send material directly from the school to the student. Now, for most people who are unengaged or not paying attention, this is, you know, this is just easier. You know, your teacher can email you your homework. However, what we saw in the largest school district out here on Long Island, surveys were sent to 15-year-old girls from the school to the Chromebook, cutting the parents out, a survey blatantly asking them about their sexual activities, how often they engage in certain kinds of sex. You know, I'll keep it PG, but you can imagine these sorts of questions that were asked in this survey. Now, look, if this is some kind of a national survey, you would think that the parents would be involved in some way. But because of the accessibility of these Chromebooks being given to the schools, it gives the opportunity for malicious teachers, for malicious administrators to cut the parents out 100%.
That is just disgusting. I mean, and the fact that they're even asking these types of questions, I mean, did they even say what the purpose was? I mean, what possible purpose would this type of survey have? And for children who aren't engaged in any kind of sexual activity, I mean, to be that explicit that we can't even talk about it on the radio, I mean, that should tell everybody listening the type of graphic content that is involved. And there's no purpose to this other than trying to over-sexualize kids at a very young age. And again, to drive that wedge between the children and the parents, and to encourage children to not be forthcoming with parents, because the quote-unquote safe space is the school, not the home anymore. And that should really give every parent pause to say, do I want my child to trust me as the parent, or am I giving them over to these educators and the state, basically, to raise them and to be the substitute for the parents? And I mean, this is just incredible. So if that was in the Long Island school district, has that gone nationally, or was that more localized in terms of the survey?
Well, no, it's definitely a national thing. We saw a story come out the other day, I believe it was in the Post Millennial, from Oregon, where a gym teacher asked his students to write an essay about what their sexual fantasies were. Now, I cannot come up with any good that could come of that, with the exception of the teacher just being curious on his own. It's not like this was a national survey that, you know, maybe they're part of some larger organization and this survey happened to go out, even if you want to give that the best of intentions. This was a handwritten essay about high school kids' sexual fantasies. This is happening across the country. And I promise you, no matter where you live, this is happening because of the teachers' unions. The teachers' unions have such a hold on these schools that even in the Project Veritas video, they explicitly say that once you have tenure as a public school teacher, which usually happens in about the fourth or fifth year, it is virtually impossible to get rid of a bad teacher, at least in the state of New York. I believe in the state of New York, it costs about $1 million to fire an incompetent teacher. Never mind a vindictive teacher, a malicious teacher. You know, right now it is not worth it for the school districts, financially speaking, to get rid of teachers who are doing this stuff. And it's important to understand that in the David Casamento video from East Meadow that Project Veritas released, he explicitly says, we are not doing this in black neighborhoods. We are only doing it in white neighborhoods. The most recent video they put out was from Jericho School District, Syosset School District, and Manhasset School District. These are three of the richest districts in the country. Jericho School District might be the richest in the entire country. They are targeting the kids who will eventually go on to elite universities. Because from elite universities, where do you go? You go into positions of power. You go from Yale to the New York Times. You go from Harvard into the government. You go from Wesleyan into places like the State Department. This is what they're doing. They're going after the next generation so that they will have influence over the culture moving forward. And we're seeing it happening in the government right now with President Biden deciding to push equity in all of the government programs.
I'm talking with Kevin Smith, who's the founder of The Loud Majority. And, you know, I think you're even giving them too much credit to say that there's, you know, even with the best of intentions, because, you know, I think there can't possibly be any good intentions. And you're absolutely right that they are targeting the kids that are going to go on to these positions of power and positions of influence on purpose to push all of this progressive agenda through the mindset of the individuals, because it's difficult enough to, you know, have these conversations as adults and to combat someone's perspectives and ideology when you're talking as two adults. But when you have a child who has been raised with this type of ideology, it's so much more difficult to break. And I just can't imagine. Even as a college student, I mean, thinking back, you know, when I was in college, I can't even imagine in that context having any sort of classroom environment or situation with a teacher where there would be any reason whatsoever other than something nefarious and downright evil, asking students, even as adult college students, to describe, you know, sexual fantasies and this kind of thing. And so, you know, so the question then is, beyond obviously taking your kids out and homeschooling or making sure that they go to a private Christian institution that is fully transparent with their curriculum and in that type of education, what can we do in terms of the school districts? And because, you know, even if our kids are homeschooled or aren't exposed to these things, this is going to have an effect, as you mentioned, Kevin, on the wider community and the wider society because of all of these positions of power and influence these kids are ultimately going to go to. So what can we do?
Well, you know what? This is where I'm optimistic, because, you know, people tend to feel very discouraged when they see national politics or when they see their state level politics. You know, you pick your governor every 4 years, but running for your local school board, you then have the ability, if you get on that school board, to give tenure to the good teachers and remove the bad ones. And this is where you can have the most impact. Something we've done a lot here on Long Island and across the state is getting parents to run for their school boards. And they are winnable. We're not talking about governor races or Senate races, something that has millions and millions of votes. You know, there was one school board race here on Long Island, we won by 60 votes.
All right.
If you're an influential member of your community, I would say find out how to run for your local school board.
Yep. Well, Kevin Smith, thanks so much. We are out of time already here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Thanks so much for being with us. Make it a great day, and I will talk with you tomorrow.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.